Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
So do you know the TED Talk series? TED stands for Technology Entertainment Design. It's a nonprofit that holds these conferences with a series of presentations dedicated to what they call ideas worth spreading. Many of you know the TED Talks. Many of you don't. Well, one of the TED Talks from 2009 that got a lot of response and really moved a lot of people was by Barry Schwartz, a Swarthmore College professor who spoke about what he called practical wisdom, a phrase first coined by Aristotle. Practical wisdom, he said, today is dying out. We live in a society so filled with rules and incentives that we are draining ourselves of the practical wisdom that we really need to be successful human beings and have a successful culture. Now he's written a book called Practical Wisdom, and we'll talk to Barry Schwartz and his co-author in a minute. First, here's just 45 seconds of the original TED Talks as Barry Schwartz riffs on the idea of wisdom.
A wise person is like a jazz musician, using the notes on a page, but dancing around them, inventing combinations that are appropriate for the situation and the people at hand. A wise person knows how to use these moral skills in the service of the right aims, to serve other people, not to manipulate other people. And finally, perhaps most important, a wise person is made, not born. Wisdom depends on experience, and not just any experience. You need the time to get to know the people that you're serving. You need permission to be allowed to improvise, to try new things, occasionally to fail, and to learn from your failures.
With us now, Barry Schwartz, Swarthmore College professor of social theory and social action. Now, that's a title and a great job. And Kenneth Sharp, Swarthmore political science professor. They are co-authors of Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Barry, welcome back. Ken, welcome to WNYC.
Pleasure to be here, Brian.
Thanks for having us.
And Barry, before we get too high concept, tell us the story that I know you love to tell of the hospital janitor that contrasts his official rules and incentives with how he really behaved in his job.
Sure. His name is Luke. He works at a major academic medical center. His job description consists of 20 or 30 or 40 tasks like emptying trash cans and washing floors and restocking cabinets, just the sort of thing you would expect. So that's his job, except that if you talk to him, he makes it clear that that's not his job. It's a small piece of his job. And he gave the people who did this work an example of what he thinks is his job. And it involved a young man who'd been in a coma for weeks and his father, who had been keeping a vigil by his bedside. And his father had stepped out and hadn't seen Luke clean the man's room and came at Luke confrontational and angry and insisted that Luke clean the room, which, of course, he had already done. So in a heartbeat, in a moment, Luke came to the realization that the right way to respond to this aggrieved and upset man was simply to nod his head, apologize, and say, "I'll clean the room."
Wow.
And then proceed to clean the room a second time.
So to swallow his pride as kind of a gift to a troubled fellow human being?
And it was a subtle gift because there were other ways not to get angry. And he says in the interview, Luke, that he did initially get angry. He had a flash of anger that he suppressed. But what he realized is that by doing this, he would give the father a sense that he was actually able to make a difference in his son's life. So it wasn't just placating the father or calming him down. It was actually making the father feel effective.
Beyond skills to wisdom. And Ken, the moral of that story goes to something that afflicts all our major institutions. Business, government, medicine, education, law, banking, parenting, even self-help books?
Absolutely. And one of the reasons, Brian, is that it wasn't just that Luke cared about the father or wanted to do the right thing or had the will to do the right thing. He actually had the moral skill to do the right thing. He could have done a lot of other things. He could have called in his boss and complained. He could have told the guy, argued with the father. He could have said, "Well, let's sit down and talk about this. I understand your pain." But those were all choices he didn't make, and he didn't make them because he had the skill to be empathetic and the skill to figure out what the father needed. And that kind of moral skill is exactly what we think institutions need to teach, as well as the moral will, in order to get good doctors and good lawyers and good teachers.
So let's take an institutional example, and let's start with education because it's so important and so on the firing line these days. And, you know, we may have a great example in today's news, actually. Mayor Bloomberg is ending his experiment with giving teachers in a given school bonuses based on that school's improvement on standardized tests. That was the incentive. All the teachers in a school get a bonus if the school's numbers go up on standardized tests, because fewer schools met the incentive baseline this year than last year. And I think, Barry, that plays right into some of the research you cite in the book.
Indeed. It's sort of frustrating and heartbreaking. I'm a psychologist, and for 30 years, psychologists have been demonstrating the limits of incentives. Incentives have their place. That place isn't every place. And the problem isn't that they aren't smart enough. You can't make them smart enough. And what happens when you incentivize the performance of what ought to simply be my job, why I'm here, is that you sort of distort what people do. They do whatever it takes to produce the bonus or the gold star instead of what it takes to educate children. So there's a side effect to using incentives. Sometimes it's worth suffering the side effect. If none of the kids are learning anything, man, you do whatever you can to try to make things better. But the trouble is that the sort of economists who run our society think there is no side effect. Incentives are simply the way the world works, and you just have to find the right ones. And that's really mistaken, and we've known that in psychology for 30 years.
Ken, you want to pick any other example of how you see incentives backfiring?
There's a simple example that was done by some researchers in psychology, which was the example of some students who were out on a street corner in a big city trying to load a couch into a truck. And what the researchers did is they had these students ask passersby for help. And when the students asked the passersby, could you give us help? We're having trouble getting the couch in. The vast majority of people would stop and help. When the students stopped passersby and said, if we give you $10, could you help us load the couch? The number of people that were willing to help dropped enormously. And one of the conclusions for that, which is so important, is not just the effect that incentives have on how students learn, but it's the effect that incentives have on the teachers. They often tend to demoralize the practice. So instead of teachers doing the right thing for the right reason, they end up doing it because of the bonus. Then you take the bonus away, and who knows what you've done to the teachers.
Ah, so you've not only negatively affected sort of the behavioral psychological outcome, you've affected the entire moral equation of a moral relationship.
Exactly.
It's not a relationship anymore. It's a relationship between you and the incentive structure, not between you and the people you're teaching or if it's a doctor treating.
Listeners, any reactions, stories to tell, questions to ask? We've already heard, you know, some compelling social science and an amazing story of one janitor in a hospital from Barry Schwartz and Kenneth Sharp, authors of the book Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Maybe one of you listening right now is in the audience when Barry Schwartz gave that TED Talk in 2009 that started this whole thing. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And you reclaim this from Aristotle. How did he first use the term practical wisdom, and why isn't it a household phrase today?
Aristotle was really in a quiet argument with one of his teachers, Plato, who emphasized the importance of wisdom, but saw wisdom on a very high, abstract plane as knowing the form of the good or the asking the big questions about what's right and what's truth. Aristotle said, you know, that's fine and good. That's an important kind of question. But the kind of wisdom we citizens need is the practical wisdom to figure out how to translate those issues into our everyday lives. And that demands understanding the context. To be a good citizen, to be a good soldier, to be a good statesman, to be a good parent, you have to know when and how to be angry, he says, for how long, and in what way? It's not an abstract question of whether anger is good or bad, and that's the same with truth, with honesty, with kindness, with humility, with courage. You got to translate those into real action, and that's why Aristotle said practical wisdom, phronesis is what he called it, was so important.
Is this another phrase for common sense?
Well, the way we distinguish – let me say two things about that. First, people, when people say that, I say, and common sense, what's that? It's like we use that phrase all the time, but I don't know what people think it means, and that includes me. But at the very least, what I think it common sense leaves out that practical wisdom has at its core is that practical wisdom is a moral activity. It's about doing the right thing by other people. It takes common sense to drive slower on an icy road. There's nothing moral about that. It takes more than just common sense for Luke to figure out how to talk to the Father. So if you like, practical wisdom is moral common sense.
But to say that it's common, Brian, is to imply that everybody just has it naturally. And the one of the points that we make is that although people have the capacity for practical wisdom, practical judgment, and moral life, it's something that they have to learn from mentors, from people who model it, from their parents, from institutions that encourage it. So when people say common sense, they often don't ask the next question, how is it that that's learned, and how can we do better in helping people learn it?
So how? I presume not by rules and incentives.
Exactly.
But how? I mean, is there – I'm sure you would say that there is a lack of instruction in this in our world today?
There's not only a lack of instruction, it's even worse. There's a lack of an appreciation for the need for instruction. And to the extent that people get instruction in ethics, it's almost always done in the wrong way. It's a course in business school, business ethics. It's ghettoized away from the other stuff, and implicitly what people learn is just how unimportant this is. Our view, and I think Aristotle's, is that the way you learn is by doing. You try, you fail, you learn from your mistakes, and over time you get closer and closer to getting it right. You're mentored by people who are looking over your shoulder, giving you guidance, and providing very, very important, providing models of, I can say this in New York, maybe not everywhere, of how a mensch behaves.
One of the cases that really struck us was the group of doctors from Harvard Medical School that work at the Cambridge Health Alliance, a small community hospital in Cambridge, who were very concerned about what they called the moral erosion amongst their medical students. And particularly in the third and fourth year, when the students had to go on hospital floors and follow attending physicians around, seeing patients for 2 or 3 minutes in kind of emergency or high-tense situations. And what they realized was that the kind of modeling that those doctors were doing for the young students was such that they weren't encouraging the students to figure out what a patient was feeling and thinking. They weren't encouraging empathy. They really weren't encouraging a kind of discernment and care for the patient. They couldn't under those kinds of conditions. And what these docs did is they completely redid the third year of medical school so that they pulled those students off the ward floors at least for half a day, put them in a mentoring relationship with one doctor every day per week, and figured out a way to actually, in their words, cause wisdom to be learned.
And yet you tell the story of the doctor who didn't want to cause his patient, who was in tremendous pain, any more pain, by making him turn over for a procedure, only to discover days later that causing him so much pain in part was this abscess on his rear that a little too much compassion made him fail to find.
No. Right? And that the doctor is Jerome Groopman, who writes for The New Yorker,
yes.
So quite a distinguished person, and he tells this story on himself.
Yes.
Too much compassion clouds judgment. The lesson, and there's no doubt that that's true, and the lesson that's been learned is therefore root compassion out. Be cold, clinical, objective. Don't let your feelings get in the way of your decisions, because all they'll do is screw them up. And what Groopman realized is that that's the wrong lesson. The challenge, and Aristotle said this, is to find the right balance, the mean, between detachment on the one hand and compassion on the other.
Barry Schwartz and Kenneth Sharp, authors of Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. And Iris in South Orange, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Well, I find this conversation fascinating because we have two children. Our 7-year-old son, we had a lot of behavioral trouble with when he was about 4 or 5, and there's still stuff that goes on. But we were advised to use a marble jar and to use that as a way, as an incentive to get him to listen and behave. And every time he did what he was asked to do or, you know, didn't terrorize his sister, he got a marble. And I just think that long term that was really not an effective way of dealing with the problem and crazy making, ultimately, for all of us.
Well, you know, what makes this so difficult is that there are real virtues to using incentives like that. They've been very, very effective with kids located somewhere on the autism spectrum as well. They're clear, they're immediate, and they, in that way, convey a message that language sometimes doesn't. The problem is that they are not enough. So you need to find a way to let them do the good work they can and then sort of wean the child off them and onto the kinds of things that regulate social interaction in most normal people's normal everyday lives. And I don't want to minimize that. It's really a hard thing to do. It's hard to do in schools. It's hard to do if you're a parent. It's necessary to find a way to do that.
Iris, thank you. Kathy in Suffolk, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question is similar to the previous caller's. My son has a reward chart. He's 5. And he lives for his rewards. And I get concerned about how to promote empathy and compassion in him, because right now he's pretty much all about what's in it for me.
The reward charts are something that are so common in schools that it's a great concern for us when it's overdone. There's a lot of research showing that you can get children who love to draw to just draw if you give them pens and pencils. And when you start giving them gold stars, they'll continue to draw until you remove those gold stars. Then they actually stop drawing, whereas the control group who never got the gold stars continues. So it's a real issue. But the alternative to that may not be eliminating those completely, but there's also research that shows that parents who ask their children to explain to them what they think the kid they got in the fight was feeling with, how the other person probably was feeling when this argument was happening. Parents who give reasons to their children for the rule or regulation that they're imposing on them or ask their children to provide reasons, they're encouraging in a very slow way their children to reflect on what they're doing and to actually learn the kind of skills that you need to be empathetic. The instinct is natural, but the ability, the skill to do it has got to be taught.
We're just about out of time, but where does this go next? If this strikes a chord in the general public, now that it's a book, as it did in the audience at your TED Talk, what happens? Do you start giving practical wisdom self-help courses around America, or does this get woven into curricula, or what?
Well, we don't, and I would say that neither of those things strike me as the right thing to do. What we hope will happen is that people who actually run organizations who see the wisdom in our book about wisdom will think hard about how to restructure those organizations so wisdom can actually be nurtured instead of suppressed. And then that's the beginning of probably a fairly long process of changing the way doctors doctor and lawyers lawyer and also how they're trained.
And that's why in the book we're very careful not to give the 10 rules for how to learn wisdom or the 10 rules to how to be a mensch. But what we do instead is provide examples of what we think are best practices, cases where it worked in schools, in law firms, in banks and elsewhere. Not that those cases are just going to be replicated, but just to get people to think comparatively. If it were possible for these people to change institutions in the cases that we put forward, what could we do? And they who are the experts inside their own institutions are going to have to work that out. We can't just kind of fly in as outside consultants and say, do this. That would be a violation of everything the book is about.
Mensch, by the way, more or less, upstanding person, straight shooter, moral soul. Barry Schwartz and Kenneth Sharp, authors of Practical Wisdom, The Right Way to Do the Right Thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll talk about some interesting aspects of President Hu's visit to the United States that may not be getting so much discussion. And then we'll try to come to grips with some of the tensions that people are feeling around the Tiger Mom book, maybe a little envy along with the dismissal, little fear of China rolled into this. And we will also have a call-in for Chinese Americans who didn't go to Stuyvesant and who don't love math and science and maybe are not so good at it. Stay with us.